My time is exact.
Wait, so is mine. That was my news.
What, really?
Yeah, like I came in here, I was like, I wish to do the cold open about time.is because I have some exciting news about it. And then you stole my thunder by saying the exact same thing.
I turned off automatic time syncing and then turned it back on to force a time sync since there's not a button in the modern Windows control panel, the settings app or whatever they call it now.
Yeah, I just have to express my delight that I opened time.is and it says your time is exact, which has never happened in the long history of using this website to sync up our recordings.
Yeah. So this is the thing that we use to sync recordings when we're remote. And mine is always at least 1 second off. So I was pretty excited that I got it to exact.
I think I've been as high as like 2.8 seconds or something, which is just like, wow. I'm basically living in the past at that point.
I know.
Your
financial transactions are all off.
Oh boy. Let's not even talk about that.
Fair.
Speaking of, did I hear you mention control panel?
Yeah, I love the control panel. It's my favorite part of Windows. The Windows
control panel.
Oh God. Like, remember when they first added that and then they grouped everything. You're like, oh God, I can't find anything anymore. And then they just got rid of the good parts of it. And now you can't, it's not even in like the little pop-up menu.
I have no problem with control panel as long as it is the only thing you need, but. And to be clear, I'm talking about old XP control panel, not new Windows settings. The touch-based thing.
That happened with Windows 8, I think, right?
Yeah.
They added Metro Settings app that had like 2/3 of the settings you need. Right. And then they left the control panel for all the other crap.
Yeah, we got pretty deep into that, I think, in the ranking of Windowses.
Yeah, it was an important part of why Windows 8 blows.
Well, I have to tell you something.
Oh, is there good news? Are they finally getting rid of the settings app and we're going back to the control panel like decent human beings?
I don't know if you're going to consider this good news. As much as I have complained about the fact that there are two different settings in Windows and that you have to use both to do everything, I think there's a worse alternative,
which is
that the word is going around that they are fully expunging the old control panel from the next build of Windows.
Well, I mean, as long as they take all of the important functionality, like all of the stuff that you can't do in the sound settings app that you need from the sound control panel into the settings app, that's fine, right? Which is surely what they're going to do.
Yes, that's definitely 100%. They will account for every possible exception. They will move all of the functionality over to the settings app.
Right now, I'm taking a really deep breath so I can get a really good sigh. Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Brad. It's good to see you, man. Yeah, how you holding up?
I'm doing all right.
Good?
It's good to see you, too, virtually.
I digitally. Know. All of my friends are screens.
You've got quite a nice overexposure going on this Saturday morning.
Yeah, hold on.
You were extremely blindingly white at the moment.
Not
that anybody can see this, but...
that's not too far from the norm.
Yeah. Okay. Fine.
What with never leaving the house now. So
yeah. What's your day count? I believe I'm on day 13. Since I set foot out of this apartment.
This is 29.
Wow.
We're almost a full month. Last night I was going to make pizza dough in the morning so we could make pizza and have family movie night last night, and we ended up. I was just like at 2 o'clock, I was like, I'm not making dough. We don't have enough. I can't waste the flour on the dough.
You just got a ration. Yep.
Yeah. And our favorite pizza place is doing contactless delivery. Like our local pizza joint does contactless delivery, although they're bad at it.
Mm.
So I ordered a couple pizzas and like having not eaten any out at all for the last like 30 days, 28 days is the longest I think we've gone without ordering some sort of external food.
Was it like ambrosia?
Oh God, that pizza was so good.
Did you know, have you been getting a lot of deliveries? Because, we're in the city on a very highly populated street. Plenty of people walking by all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel bad about having to order a lot of stuff, but I just need a lot of gear for the stuff I'm doing at home for work.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. You need a full studio in the house now.
Yeah. So I've probably taken 8 or 10 deliveries since this has been going on, but they have both, FedEx and UPS have both taken to ringing the bell and just dropping the packages on the sidewalk and leaving.
Oh boy. Which is
incredible.
Like, I can't blame them. Home.
I can't. Well,
it's not like you're not there.
So that my girlfriend made that exact point, because like the first couple times they did that, I was like, this is, you just put like $150 worth of stuff in a little box, just sitting on the, a lot of people walk by that door every minute. Well, maybe fewer right now, but then yes, probably, she made the point that like, yes, they know everybody is in the house right now. So it is probably safe to assume that somebody's going to hear the bell and immediately come get it, which is what's happened every time. But, and also I cannot blame them for not wanting to interact with people.
Yeah, like I gave my UPS driver a virtual fist bump because I was out walking with my daughter in the afternoon, and like we saw him and I was like, hey, how's it going? Yeah. But he had his full mask on and the whole thing.
I'm not blaming
delivery
them at
people
all.
Are heroes.
Definitely, man. Not. Yeah. It's just it's something to be vigilant about.
Yeah. Yeah. It's we get a lot of packages because we have a bunch of school stuff coming. Can we talk about, so first off, we didn't do a lot of questions last week, so we're going to do another question episode this week.
Hopefully everybody's okay. If you despise email episodes and don't want us to do two back-to-back like this, well, then let us know.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say we probably, I can't imagine we would do one again in the future. Next week, I think we have another special guest lined up.
Oh, cool.
And we're going to talk about something cool and old. So,
oh, great. I like cool and old.
Yeah. But in the meantime, I want to hear how the studio stuff is like. Hey, by the way, on our walk yesterday, I saw something really important.
Oh,
there were 2 22-inch monitors Acer on the side of the street.
What?
I almost grabbed them for you. I was like, these are going to be great. You could put 2 more in there. You'll have like 1 normal size modern monitor. Only VGA though. So
what? Oh, wow. Dude, come on. Like even my monitors have DVI on them. Come on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not doing analog in here.
I'm sure they have DVI, Brad.
I've been dancing around this topic for the last 3 weeks or so, and I feel like I should just come out with it, which is that both of those monitors are sitting on the floor of my living room right now.
I'm going to take you one step farther, and you can do the exact same thing that my neighbor did and put them out on your sidewalk and write free on them, and then they won't be your problem anymore.
Well, the situation is that I am using temporary work monitors.
Yeah.
I got a second monitor in here for work.
Uh-huh.
So I'm in a weird limbo where people keep giving me shit about my old monitors, and like deep down I know like I'm not using those monitors right now.
I know, but if you get rid of the old ones when you have to take the new ones back to work, it's going to bring the whole thing to head, and you're going to have to make a decision. I guess
so. So the reason I've been avoiding this topic is that I want to give people the triumphant feeling of catharsis that they're looking for with a Sokka when I get actual awesome new monitors. But this is just a weird limbo right now where I have better monitors, but they're not the ultimate monitors, you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're good enough, but like, they're not yours.
Right, and people don't want good enough out of this story, this long running.
No, God, I need catharsis at this point. I want you to turn something on and have it so blindingly glorious compared to your old Garbo monitors that your eyes are seared out of your skull.
Yeah, and the culmination of this story can't just be, oh, I got a couple of good enough monitors from work and that's it. So just pretend pretend that I'm still using the shitty old monitors for now. Anyway.
Yeah.
All right.
So how's the home studio stuff going? What's your setup like these days?
Cause we get it's good. I've done 100 things since I've been stuck here to get my, you know, console capture and like I'm spending all kinds of time learning the ins and outs of OBS, which are idiosyncratic to say the least.
Have you got a Stream Deck yet, Brad?
No.
You should get one of those. It's real handy.
Jeff and Vinny both have wired up their own kind of like homebrew. Sort of Stream Deck / like kind of button interface. Like Vinny took an old MIDI controller and
set
it up.
If you have like a mechanical keyboard that you can if you have a keyboard that you can program macros into, you can use that too.
Yeah.
But the Stream Deck's pretty. So the Stream Deck is a little thing from Elgato. It's basically like a little screen that has some touchpad buttons on top of it.
Yeah.
So the buttons are, it's like a capacitive screen and the buttons trigger this thing. So you can have like little images of whatever it is. And you can, the neat thing about it for when you're streaming or doing audio stuff or recording or whatever, is that you can program really complicated macros that are like two-way macros. So like one turns something on and that thing is like 5 things and then one turns those 5 things back off or okay, whatever so does Windows, setting you want.
Does Windows not read those as keyboard presses? Like it's not taking key input for those? Okay.
So you can make the Stream Deck software make a button do a key press.
But they don't have to be key presses, right?
It does not have to be key presses.
The reason I ask is if you want to get all ambitious and program some hotkeys in OBS or set up hotkeys for like start stream, stop stream, start recording, et cetera,
yeah.
You should really make sure that those aren't the exact same hotkeys that you also set up in, like, say, your music player for play and pause and like new playlist and stuff.
Yep.
And then you definitely shouldn't find that out right in the middle of an important stream that needs to not be effed up.
I have a bunch of nonsense in it.
Yeah. So that's why, anyway, what? Yes. Like, it's.
Did you start playing Rihanna, Brad?
No. Oh, I stopped a stream.
Oh, no.
That's what I'm saying. No. That's like when I. And it happened to be an important podcast.
Oh, no.
That needed to not be interrupted, but I thought I was getting cheeky and going to play some music for the podcast, and instead I killed the stream and the recording at the same time.
Oops.
Anyway. Oops. All right. The one thing, I mean, yeah, I've set up a ton of audio stuff. The one thing, special thanks to some of the folks in our Patreon Discord for their help with this stuff. I know a couple people might be interested to hear the conclusion of this story.
Really seamless plug there, by the way.
I was taking analog audio out of this monitor that I've got. It's got HDMI in, which is what I'm running like the consoles to, because I need a screen to play a console game on while I'm streaming. Mm-hmm. And the only audio out it has is an analog, just a 3.5 millimeter analog jack. I was running that into both like the line in on my PC and like a cheap USB kind of sound card that I've got. And I was just getting wretched, just nasty electrical interference, you know, lines and pops and buzzes and just, you know, gross, you know what electrical interference sounds
like. Yeah, it sounded like garbage.
On analog audio. And some people recommended getting an audio ground loop isolator.
Uh-huh.
Which,
I've never had those work for me.
So like that's the thing with this. I finally got it because, you know, Amazon shipping is taking a long time right now, so it took a couple weeks, but I got it and literally just plugged it in line between the cord coming out of the monitor and the line in on my motherboard.
Yeah.
Absolutely, like, stunned. It is as clean as you could ask for. Like, it removed every bit of it. Like, because, you know, motherboard analog audio ports are, like, notoriously noisy themselves.
Yeah.
Regardless of, like, if you've got a ground loop situation going on. But like the audio coming in on that line in is like pristine. Like it was a $15 little dongle. And
so
I cannot believe how well it cleaned up that audio. Like it's just shocking to me.
So the last time I tried to use one of those was probably 5 or 10 years ago when I had 5.1 speakers in my office still back in the old days. And the speakers had to plug into a different plug than the PC plugged into, and it happened to be on different circuits in the house.
Okay.
So like my PC and all that stuff plugs into one that I had wired in when we moved into the house. So there'd be enough power in here for all the stuff I wanted to do. That's a brand new clean circuit. And the speakers had to plug in someplace else, 'cause I wanted the subwoofer back in the back corner. And, the ground loop isolator would never do what I needed to do across different breakers, basically. Okay.
I am talking way out of my depth here, but my understanding was that the ground loop happens when they're all on the same circuit.
Mm-mm.
Or do I have that wrong? Is that backwards?
Usually you can solve the ground loop problem by plugging everything into the same power strip. Is my interesting.
Okay. I've got some esoteric situation because my PC is plugged into a UPS and the monitor
You might have also had, well, so that would definitely do it.
Okay.
Also have been getting other noise. So like, for example, if I move my headset microphone too close to my LED backlit mechanical keyboard,
sure,
I get all sorts of weird EM noise into the microphone from the keyboard, from whatever electronics are on the keyboard.
Yeah. And this is like a 20-foot aux cord, which like Vinny was saying.
That's a long 3.5.
Vinny was saying a cord of that length is basically just acting as a giant antenna.
Yeah.
And it's threaded behind my desk where I've got all the cables routed between like, there's a Raspberry Pi back there. There's a little HDMI splitter. There's the little USB capture device I'm using. Like there's a bunch of powered devices that cord is like winding its way through.
Well, and USB is noisy too. So like if you have a USB cable crossing that has data going across it, crossing an XLR cable, which is really well shielded and designed to not be a giant antenna, you can get USB noise across the XLR even. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, USB power is not a problem. It's just data.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so I shouldn't like pitch this thing as a one size fits all panacea or anything like that. But whatever specific interference situation I have going on, like I just plug that thing in and it completely cleaned it up. And I could not.
That's awesome that it worked. Yeah.
It's $15 on Amazon.
So it's funny, I, to solve that problem, rather than fix the cable routing so that my cables don't cross, I just use a pair of XLR studio monitors that I had. Nice. And run XLRs around the back of the desk, and they just run over everything, and they're pretty bulletproof except for the occasional USB noise.
Sure.
So, okay. So you got like a Elgato card or something to do some capture.
It's a Magewell. Not exactly a prominent brand. Everybody talks about Elgato, and like I think Blackmagic is a big one in that space. But like Magewell, I think, is a little company out of China, probably, that I don't even know if they make internal cards. I know they make these kind of inline USB 3 capture devices. But anyway, the one I've got is like 4 years old or something like that. That's been working pretty well.
Okay. I have a Blackmagic Intensity Pro 4K in my streaming PC that captures input from the gaming PC.
Right. And that's an internal card.
I have two of those, one's for the camera and one's for the other computer.
That's elaborate.
We also use them for foo stuff. So,
justifiable.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a justifiable expense.
Are those PCI or PCI Express?
Those are PCI Express.
Okay.
I don't have any PCI. I don't think there's any PCI slots in my computer.
I have been eyeballing the specs on my motherboard a lot more the last 3 weeks to see what all I could pull off in a pinch. And my board still has two old PCI slots.
Oh, wow.
So
the 4K cards all have to be PCI Express, I think, because of the amount of bandwidth for the video.
Oh, sure.
The problem with those Blackmagic cards is they don't do gaming monitor resolutions.
Ah.
So it does 1080p 60, no problem, but it doesn't know what to do with 1440p. And it only does 4K at 30 Hertz, I think, not 60 Hertz.
Yeah.
So it's not like the upshot is it's pretty easy to do a capture card at 1080p. Like the Elgato ones are good. The Blackmagic cards are great at 1080p 60, but things start to get weird beyond that.
Sure. We just got to get to this glorious, fully compliant HDMI 2.1 future and everything will be fine.
It takes so long.
I know.
It takes so long.
I know.
But yeah, so that's my setup is basically the same as it always has. I haven't changed anything.
Yeah.
I have the audio interface, which I think we're going to talk about in a few minutes normal computer stuff.
Yeah. All right. Should we get into some emails here?
Yeah. You want to do some emails?
Sure. Like emails.
Questions.
Where did these emails get sent to?
We have an email address. It's techpod@content.town. Just the URL for the podcast, but with an at instead of a dot between the first two words.
That is, that's fancy.
When you control the domain, you control everything.
Yeah, I guess so. I've been doing, I shouldn't even bring this up. I've been dabbling with some PowerShell scripting recently.
Ooh.
So as soon as you said that, my mind immediately went to like, how would you like dynamically change out one delimiter for another? How would you
get in the bash? You in the TCH?
I swear to God, I am not going out of my way to plug this Discord, but I have been talking to some folks in there about that stuff. PowerShell is kind of a pain in the ass to work with.
Yeah, PowerShell sucks. People who are good at it, it's awesome, but I'm not good at it, so it sucks.
Yeah, well, it's got some weird quirks. Anyway, that new Windows subsystem for Linux is coming soon.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as soon as that happens, I'm going to install that and start switching over to learning to do bash scripting and never look back.
You got to get up that beard. You got time to grow that thing.
I know.
Time to make it happen.
Anyway, okay, let's read some emails. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
This is not just my personal stream of consciousness, or maybe it is.
That's what people are here for, Brad. They want to hear us talk about the shit that we talk about in the Discord chat all day long.
Anyway, big thanks to those folks for giving me some pretty good actionable info on a variety of things.
I am looking
in that domain.
Look, I am looking very hard. The Mr. Conversation that is ongoing.
Oh my God.
Has me so close.
I don't even know if we're going to get to emails. We could just talk about things that have been going on lately. So I got my DE10 Nano in the mail.
Oh, you did? You've ordered the parts?
Yeah.
So what else do you have coming?
The thing that was stopping me was that nobody had the SD RAM module in stock, which is the thing you need for pretty much everything.
Like any Neo Geo and
more than even that, like GBA I think cores
and stuff like that.
The only cores I know of that don't run or that run without the SDRAM are Genesis, maybe PC Engine, but like,
okay.
And maybe one or two like of the old computers, but like just about every console needs the RAM.
We should explain what the Mister is. It's a FPGA based hardware emulation.
Yeah.
So an FPGA is a kind of CPU that can reconfigure itself dynamically.
Yeah. To be other chips.
To mimic other chips. And basically what this is doing is it's mimicking old console hardware on a little box that's about the size of like a USB portable USB charger, maybe.
Well, the actual board is basically a Raspberry Pi. Like in terms of the way it looks and the form factor, it's that.
Yeah.
It's an SBC, a small board computer.
So then Mister is a software project that uses a specific FPGA that's pretty available for what, like $150? It's not super expensive.
So the DE10 Nano is the name of the actual board people buy that is the basis of this thing. And yeah, it's base price is $130 depending on where you get it. The whole reason, I don't know if everybody knows this, but the whole reason that thing is so cheap is because Intel apparently subsidizes it pretty heavily.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Because like bigger and more capable FPGA systems are like way more expensive.
Yeah.
So the reason everybody's using this thing is because it's so affordable.
FPGAs are expensive to manufacture.
Real quick, I just have to, somebody in the Discord dropped this line and I apologize for forgetting who it is, but it's the most like succinct way I have ever heard to explain what an FPGA actually does.
Ooh.
Which is that with normal software, you're telling a CPU what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And with an FPGA, you are telling it what hardware to be.
Yeah.
So like you're literally saying be the chips that make up the Super Nintendo main board inside this chip. Like it is reconfiguring itself to like electrically, right? Like at the electrical level, it is becoming the chips. More or less. I think that's a simplified explanation.
So does that mean I can, like, if I load up the Genesis core, I can configure it to be the type of Genesis, like the rev of Genesis that has the audio hardware I'm accustomed to?
I don't know if the core for the Genesis has that level of specificity, but I don't see any reason they couldn't do that if they wanted to offer different cores that had those. But yeah, I don't know if people know that different revisions of the Genesis had slightly different versions of that Yamaha chip, so the music would sound a little bit different. So like depending on which Genesis you had as a kid, you have a different idea of what the correct Genesis music sound is.
As a kid, I got a Genesis when I was in college, Brad.
Well, that's okay. We're not all.
Look, I played a lot of NHL and Madden. That's all I'm saying. It was very popular.
Not all of our beards are quite that gray yet, but So just to expand on that stuff, I don't know if we have we talked about the Mister much. Are we retreading this?
No, we haven't really. We do a lot of podcasts. I've talked about it on other podcasts. Yeah. I think we've talked about it a bunch here.
The reason I ask is it's kind of topical right now because I don't know if are you familiar with the SNES emulator BSNES?
Yeah, and we did an article about on it Untested years and years ago when it was finished.
Like Hegen or I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but there's
Hegen. I thought Hegen was how you say it, but I don't know.
So Bu is the author of those things, of those emulators. Hagen in particular is known as like the most accurate Super Nintendo emulator in the world. Like that was his whole goal with that thing was cycle accurate emulation of that hardware.
And like, it takes an incredibly beefy computer. So to that's run the thing I had forgotten. Emulators.
That's the thing I had forgotten. And talking to people about the Mister and the FPGA stuff, that's what really drove home why this thing is so beneficial. Is that to get that level of accuracy for just the Super Nintendo, you need like 3 to 4 gigahertz. And you're like maxing cores. Maxing that horsepower to get that level of accuracy. And you're getting the same kind of accuracy on this little $130, like tiny little thing that takes like no power.
So it works. I mean, the more commercial versions of this type of thing are a company called Analog. That's I think in the EU or UK makes these really high end like consoles that you can put actual cartridges into that use similar technology. But I think this is the kind of homebrew version. And it seems like it's definitely like I've been on UPFs and stuff where Jeff busted his out and we played old TI games and looked and felt exactly like I remember TI games. So I mean, bad. They looked bad.
The analog consoles, that's like the NT Mini, the Mega SG, the Super NT. Those are the names of those actual consoles.
Yeah.
Those things are known for being really accurate. Like their core development focuses on making sure the emulation, or it's not emulation, but the software runs accurately on the virtual hardware. But I've seen some people saying that because of the open source nature of the cores on the Mister, they are actually starting to achieve even better accuracy because, like, you know, just by nature of so many different people banging on the same on the same development.
Well, the people who are really into whatever weird esoteric game that would find an error on something else will go in and fix their problems that they find. And yeah, it's good.
It's a pretty exciting project. Anyway, the whole reason I brought all that up is that I finally got my package from a well-known electronics reseller that will remain nameless.
Okay.
And it looks like somebody got the DE10 Nano box with a forklift. There was a
hole
poked in the top of the box, like pretty savagely.
Is the card okay?
So, like, based on what I could see, the way things were laid out inside the box, the board, the actual DE10 was not right underneath where the hole is. Whew. And it appears to, I haven't booted it up yet, but it appears to be undamaged.
Whew.
But, like, I don't know how that happens, man. That's, like, frightening that they shipped that out. It did not happen in shipping because the outside of the box was fine and it was wrapped in bubble wrap inside and that was all fine. It had to have happened in the warehouse or before it was packed for shipping because the actual retail box was just straight up punctured. And
are you sure
outside
that UPS
of the box
didn't
was completely
do it
fine.
And repackage? I've had UPS reprint labels and rebox stuff that they've damaged before.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, that's devious. I did not consider that.
It might have been USPS that I saw did that, but like I've had packages come that like were damaged in shipping.
They used a new box.
They
just wanted to cover their tracks.
No. It was more like they didn't think there was anything wrong with it, and they were like, "Hey, we want to go ahead and get this to you."
Oh, but they cops to it. If they actually told you that they repackaged it.
There was a letter inside. I want to say this was from the USPS. It was like, "Hey, the original box this was shipping was damaged in transit. Okay. So we replaced it with this one. If there's something wrong, here's the number to call."
I did not get any such messaging. Also, this was delivered by UPS.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know. I feel weird about it. Like, I think it's fine. I should boot it up and try to make sure that everything's good.
If it works, then it's fine. Cares about the packaging?
But it's just, it's a little alarming.
It's not great. It's not what you want.
To get your new thing in the mail and see it. Anyway.
Should we answer a question? We're 28 minutes in. I feel like this is the time for questions.
Even have time for emails at this point? Okay.
It's hard to say.
All right. Here we go. Here is the first email from Adam with a subject line of regarding poopy Windows 10 blue screen. In episode 22, Will brought up Windows 10's frowny face blue screen. That's the generic blue screen that you get now that doesn't actually change based on the nature of the error. It's just the same QR code every time, right? That just sends you to a generic landing page. Something went wrong. Completely useless.
This makes me sad just thinking about it.
Yeah. He says, I've found that you should be able to change a registry entry to switch back to the classic Windows blue screen with actual information on it. And he included a link and I've got it right here. I don't know if you just want me to read out a registry key right here on the podcast.
Okay. Look, this is the content people crave. Give me all those good registry keys, Brad.
We'll put this. How many other podcasts on the internet can you go to for hot registry flips?
Our new tagline, the number one source of Windows hot Windows registry keys. Man. Brad and Will made a tech pod.
Yeah. Okay. We'll put it in the show notes if people actually want it, but it's HKEY local machine, / system, / current control set, / control.
Oh, yeah.
/ crash control. You create a new D word value called display parameters and set it to one.
Oh yeah. Give me those good D word values.
Anyway, it's a super easy. I mean, anybody that's fiddled in the registry knows that takes 30 seconds to do. I just think it's ironic that we are actually seeking out the old blue screen these days, considering how everybody used to feel about it.
Well, so before I found out about this, I used to use the Windows debugger to do kernel debugging, where you set the blue screen to save a dump or a mini dump, which is basically like the parts of memory that are relevant to the crash. And then you can go in and look and see what actually seg faulted or whatever.
Huh.
But this seems much better because then you can just look at it on the screen and then type that thing in. And have valid information.
Yeah, and you can get back to seeing like which driver or file caused the error and that kind of thing.
So the word I heard on the QR code from an unnamed source inside that is positioned to know is that the reason there's only one QR, like originally somebody was like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if the QR code took you to an error for the blue screen? And then when they started actually doing it, then the number of QR codes that would be required were took a lot of space and memory space. And that space is like the kernel has to fit into a relatively small amount of space in the memory.
I'm surprised QR codes can't just be encoded on the fly. I mean, is there not, there's got to be just a standard.
I'm sure they can, but then they'd have to have the program then code like if you're trying to fit this all into 640K or whatever ridiculous.
I guess that algorithm would have to live in some protected space where it would actually still run after everything else crashed, right?
Yeah. So
I didn't even think about that.
It sounded like it was, hey, this was a good idea. Once it impacted the reality of Windows, was not able to be implemented in the way it was originally envisioned. So instead it just became a link to the, hey, sorry, your Windows is broken.
Right. Page. How hard is it to enable that kernel debugger?
You have to download it. I think it might be a default thing. It's WinDebug, WinDBG. And, KD/KL to launch it.
Okay.
KD-KL.
I'll probably just make this registry change and move on. But also, I don't think I've seen a blue screen in years at this point. So
when you get real into like low latency audio stuff, you're going to see more blue screens because when the timing gets out of whack, then they bomb out the whole system.
And you might be running drivers that are less than ideal.
Look, the people who make audio hardware and the people who write drivers, good drivers, there's that Venn diagram doesn't overlap at all.
Sure. I bought a USB 3 expansion card, like a PCIe card with a bunch of USB 3 ports on it, just because I'm running out of ports because I'm plugging so many things in now.
Have you considered a hub?
But I kind of wanted some stuff just right in the back of the PC.
Okay.
And it was cheap. But that's the thing, though. Then I had to eyeball, like, oh, what USB chipset does this use? What are the drivers like for this? Because if I have to go get some no-name driver that's going to make my system super unstable, this is super not worth it. But they said it's got a built-in Windows driver. It's plug and play. So I'm guessing that'll be fine.
Has it come yet?
No, that's like a month out.
Hey, well, let me know how it goes. I've had mixed results with those. I delved into that world when VR was new.
Yeah.
And I was trying to have two VR headsets plugged in all the time, so I didn't have to go unplug and replug when I was switching between Oculus and Vive development.
Yeah.
Putting a USB card in did not solve that problem.
Yeah, I did see one Amazon review on this particular card said that it didn't work well with their Oculus Rift. So that's probably a concern, but that's not a problem for me because I'm not using an Oculus Rift.
The first gen Oculus used a shitload of USB bandwidth and power because it had two webcams and the headset were all powered by USB.
So maybe it was just, this card is just not, doesn't fit with the spec that thing needs.
Yeah, the motherboards that were, what was it? I can't remember what the chipset was, like, was two generations back now. Their USB bus implementation was bad for that. So you had to plug, like when you added a third Oculus camera, you had to plug two into USB 3 and one of them had to be plugged into USB 2 or else it would overload the amount of bandwidth that you had available on the USB 3.1 bus shared between all the devices.
I'm just going to render an opinion here. That's too many USB ports to require for a single device.
I mean, they don't sell it anymore for pretty good reason, I think.
That's fair. I have to say, like, honestly, my favorite thing about the Windows Mixed Reality headset I have is just how simple the setup is. You literally plug the HDMI cable into your video card and one USB 3 port in through the motherboard and you're done. That's it.
Well, so that's the way the Rift S works.
Okay.
It's the way the Index works.
Right.
I really wish.
But does the Rift S have inside out tracking yet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Rift S is inside out tracking. Okay,
so that's equivalent then, because this thing, you know, unlike the Vive, this thing has no external sensors. I mean, that's literally all you do. You plug those two things in and it uses the built in cameras for the tracking and that's it.
Yeah. The Index, for a while they were selling a dongle that would let you plug into the USB-C port on your NVIDIA card.
Huh.
Because the RTX,
USB-C ports now?
Yeah, the RTX card has a USB 3.1 port that's compatible, USB-C port that's compatible with the VR over all one cable spec,
which was
part of USB 3.1, I think. But it's a separate, like, it's a $70 dongle, and it's functionally equivalent to just plugging in the headset to the power and the USB and HDMI or DVI or whatever it has, display port.
Does that USB-C port on the video card also support, I forget how they refer to the standard. I think it has to support Thunderbolt, which means display. Like it can do display port over USB-C.
I believe so, yes.
So you can plug that into a monitor?
I have not tried it, but I believe that that is the case.
Are they still putting two DisplayPort ports on there as well?
I think I have three DisplayPorts, one HDMI and the USB-C.
Wow, all on that one video card?
All on one. Yeah, because it's a double-wide video card.
That's Genesis. Genesis. That's generous.
Look, man. Too much. Now you're playing with power.
Too much Mister on the brain lately. All right, let's move on to another email.
Question the second.
This is from Martin in London, day 8 of quarantine. Do you guys think the folding at home project will ever achieve anything notable? It's seemingly the biggest coming together of compute power in history, but it's not making the news that much. Moreover, we've never had a pandemic with the tech humanity now has available to help. Can AI, for example, be useful? I don't think we're there with AI yet. That's just my personal gut feeling. Like maybe in some limited cases, there's some like heavy processing that it could.
So the machine learning stuff that we do now is really good at finding unspecific patterns, but it requires you have a good data set to start. I think we talked about this a few weeks ago, but so I don't actually know if folding at home is ever. I'm sure folding at home has done stuff.
Yeah,
we live in California where if you go above the amount of power that your neighbors are using, your rate goes up dramatically for every clump of power you're using more than your neighbors. So I haven't run a shared computing thing on my computers in 20 years since I moved out of Tennessee. So I really don't have any idea. I know the SETI at home people never found aliens. I think they did find some interesting stuff along the way.
Okay.
Like when I look at their, hey, here's what we accomplished with folding at home page. The most recent one I was able to find was from 2015. And mostly it's about upgrading infrastructure to support more clients.
Okay.
And not like here's the here's the diseases they're targeting. Here's the stuff. Like I'm not seeing like, hey, we discovered the way a protein folds that changed the way we treat cancer or anything like that.
Yeah.
I feel like we would have probably heard about that. Probably. So yeah. I don't know. I'm curious. I'm also curious how folding compares to, say, a modern supercomputer cluster that includes a fuck ton of CPUs and GPUs and is able to do exaflops of data per second.
Yeah. Especially as more and bigger cores per CPU are becoming a thing.
Well, and having talked to people at multiple supercomputer centers over the years, like the hard part is dealing with latency in a lot of cases.
Huh.
So like, you know, Turing machines are interesting because all of our computers are based on the idea that we have like infinite memory and you have like, it's all linear, right? So we're like a modern computer is still essentially a Turing compatible computer because it all runs on one tape. Like the memory can be a paper tape that has ones and zeros punched into it. That's infinity long for all intents and purposes.
Sure.
And with like managing the latency between a million cores so that you everything's not just stalled all the time waiting on more data coming in, it turns out is a lot of the challenge of modern supercomputer clusters, like scaling them above a certain point. And folding just blows right through that number. So if anybody's listening and knows the answer, I guess what I'm saying is send it in. We'll talk about it more. Yeah. I'm curious whether I don't know the answer, wasn't able to find it. So
what you're saying is that daisy chaining thousands of CPUs together doesn't just work.
No, I mean, they've done it. Like, just to be clear, I don't want to diminish what they've done because the work that they've done is incredible.
No. What I mean is
in terms of computing,
you can't just parallelize all that stuff and expect it to go. Is what I'm saying. Like, you have to do a lot of work to make sure it all actually is.
Like, you have to do a lot of work if all the computers in the same building, if the computers are spread out a lot, distributed around the world, like that's amazing and is really cool. But I don't know what the output of it is. Yeah. And I don't run it because I don't want to pay more for electricity. I'm cheap.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
If you want to do something that you can do at home, the thing to do is to make masks.
Okay. Well, actually, that's a good segue into The next question, which I had starred here and I lost it. Here it is. It's from Eric in Wisconsin. Unless we didn't talk about 3D printing last week, did we?
I don't think so.
Did I? I really hope I didn't read this email last week. I think I was going to did. And ran out of time. All right. Apologies if we talked about this. Time is a flat circle. Can't really keep up so much these days. Eric in Wisconsin. Man. I'd love to hear your thoughts on 3D printing, the different technologies utilized in the hobby, the use cases you have found, and recommendations for hardware and software. I've considered diving into the hobby in the past, and now my kids, ages 7 and 9, are showing interest. So I thought of that because you're seeing a lot of stories out there about 3D printing being used for masks and respirators, and like you're even seeing people talking about like valves for ventilators being made in 3D printers in a pinch and some stuff like that. So like it's kind of topical.
So, most of the home printers are FDM printers, fused deposition model, which means you melt something and it gets really hot and goopy. And then you have a nozzle that squirts it onto the layer below that. And it just keeps building up from the bottom.
And so does that still come out with that sort of layered spaghetti look?
I mean, the thing that you saw when we worked together 8 years ago on the reg is indistinguishable. I mean, is not representative of what modern FDM printers can do.
No relation to current tech. Okay.
Yeah. So if you have a good Prusa or Ultimaker or whatever your favorite FDM printer is, you can make stuff that has a tenth of a micron. A micron. Like, yes, it will still have you'll still be able to see the ridges if you get really close to it and use your close up eyes or a magnifying glass.
It's much higher resolution, is what you're saying.
It is much, much higher resolution. And the motors are like the other thing that's happened is the motors are much faster and better. People have gotten better at designing chassis to avoid slack in the end of the motors. So the movements are more precise and they're much, much, much more better, much better than they were when we were doing a lot of 3D printing stuff at Tested, even in like when I was doing 3D printing stuff at Tested in 2015.
Yeah.
The big change. The other thing that's changed is that other types of printers are available. I haven't spent a lot of time with these, but like SLA printers, is it SLA? Yeah, I think so. SLA printers use light to cure a resin. So they build, so basically you have a laser that can cure an entire area in the build area in like a couple of fractions of a second. And then it lowers the build platform down. So the models build down into this goop, into the resin. And then there's processing that goes at the end of those. So like you have to wipe them, you have to clean them off with isopropyl and set them in a UV thing to cure. So they get super hard, over a period of time. But you can build much higher precision at a little bit faster speed with that. I've seen a lot of people building stuff with FDM printers. I'm seeing a lot of people building like face shield holders. So the things that go around your head and then you can put a piece of clear plastic on that and have an impromptu face shield.
That is something I wanted to ask about because I had seen people talking about printing face shields for this crisis, but okay. So the thing I was going to ask was, can you print transparent stuff like that? But it sounds like you need to source the actual mask part separately.
So you can get transparent filament, but it won't be clear enough to work through in a medical context, I would think. But what people are doing is getting the clear, bendy, transparent plastic, right, which is, I think,
the part
PTFE or PTG or something like that. And then you cut that to size and put a couple holes in it and mount it into your frame.
Sure.
The other thing is a friend of mine, Jeff Solon in Chicago, recently posted a design for a laser compatible plastic headband, printed headband and frame for face shields as well. And the benefit there is that while it may take hours to print one or two or three pieces on a big 3D printer, the laser can do all the cuts needed in like 2 or 3 minutes for a mid-range, you know, Glowforge or Epilogue or something like that.
Yeah. And is it still the case that you probably need to be in a fairly major city for this, but there are still maker shops out there where you can just rent time and go do stuff like that?
I bet all of that stuff is closed right now.
Well, I mean, just generally, like that is still a thing, or did that?
Well, so the big commercial one was Tech Shop, right? And they went under 2 or 3 years ago now. Okay,
so that was my question, was if that was just kind of a fad that came and went, or if that was an actual sustainable business.
So there are maker spaces. Like, the thing that's funny that's happened is a lot of libraries, a lot of public libraries have put in maker spaces. A lot of schools, like the Field Museum in Chicago, has a maker space that's available to every Chicago resident.
I should look into that. Like, SF has a pretty decent public library system.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if our public library. The thing is, 3D printers are not great for maker spaces because they take a long time to run.
Oh, sure.
If you want to get into 3D printing, what I would do is look at low end. Like the difference between a low end and a high end 3D printer isn't necessarily resolution; it's speed. So, you know, if you're setting up in the garage and just going to let it run, and want to have a thing to do with your kids, getting a cheap 3D printer that's slow isn't going to mean you're not able to print stuff, and they resell pretty well.
Okay.
So, like, you can buy a cheap one, use it for a little bit. If it's good and you're going to get into it, then you can upgrade, sell the old one and upgrade, or keep the old one as a way to do secondary parts. And then move on to a higher end model when you're ready to spend more time or money on it.
Sure. Okay. So it sounds like still providing your own hardware is the big barrier to entry.
I mean, I think the library is a good place to start, but you're not going to print something that takes 14 hours at the library. Right. Right.
Yeah.
And when I see this, the interesting stuff that people are building, for the most part, this is a 4 or 5. I'm not even going to print something that takes 3 hours. I don't want to hang out at the library for 5 hours on a Saturday if I can help it.
There's worse places to spend a few hours, but I get it.
Look, I like the library, but yeah.
Yeah. The library was a nice place to go when I set up the VPN for my house and I needed an external internet connection. I walked down
to
the library.
You were just testing?
I walked down to the library with my laptop and VPN to my house from two blocks away to make sure it was going to work.
Okay.
That works.
Okay, I can see that. Yeah.
Real quick, just because he asked about like just some practical uses, like I haven't done this myself, obviously, but are you familiar with a site called My Mini Factory?
No, I've not seen that. I've not heard of that before.
This is the first time I've been. I just got linked to it from the Discord again. And it looks like, and I'm sure there's a ton of these. It looks like a site where people basically upload like 3D print designs, and you can pay in this case $19.95 and download the design files and print yourself.
Oh, that's cool.
But in this case,
so this is designs, not printing.
That appears to be the case. Like there's an add files to cart button on this design. So I'm assuming you pay the $19.95 and you get the whatever format of files you need to load into the program to print. Anyway, it's a NAS case. It's like a tiny little, and it always comes back to NASs around here, but it's a tiny, tiny little PC case with like a vented, like mesh looking front. So like good airflow and space for a bunch of hard drives kind of close together and like good fan coverage on those. But it's like a tiny, tiny looking little case that would hold like a full on. I'm guessing it's mini ITX. Yes, it's a mini ITX motherboard form factor, tiny little case that holds a bunch of hard drives. So yeah, that's like $20 for the design plus you print and you can make your own little NAS case.
So I guess what I'm
saying more generally is like it's a good way for. Like, you know, there are PC cases out there for most purposes, but like finding the exact thing you want is in the exact size you want is not always super easy. So here's somebody that was just like, I'm just going to design my own super small NAS case that you can put in a corner and not have to think about.
So the thing I would say about PC cases is that the precision required for those to work right is pretty high.
Oh, sure.
I'm not sure that I don't know that I would try 3D printing a case for things that have moving parts inside.
Okay.
Like I would absolutely without hesitation print a case for a Raspberry Pi or a Mister or something like that.
Totally.
That you can kind of just wedge it in there and it doesn't require like lining up with the mounting holes.
And obviously this, like I'm looking at the pictures and there's like a bunch of screw holes and some hinges on it and stuff. Like there's definitely moving parts, but I will say in the description, it says the first 100% 3D printable mini server and NAS chassis in its class that's truly printable has been printed, has been assembled, has been beta tested by an international team and even modified by others.
So I think in order, like this is not a good start. What I'm trying to say is this is not a good starter project.
Definitely not. I'm just saying like this is an example of
this is a hard 3D print.
Yeah, this is just an example of things that people are starting to use this stuff for. And there's a gallery of people who have printed this and uploaded photos, which is kind of cool to look at.
Yeah, so this site looks like Thingiverse, but it gives you the option of charging for your stuff, which is exciting.
Yeah.
I'm into this. I hadn't seen this. If you want laser cut Mister cases and stuff like that, that's something I can do.
Ooh,
by the way.
Okay.
I don't have a working three. I have a 3D printer. It's not hooked up right now. I find myself using the laser way more than I use the 3D printer just sure. because, I mean, the entry point for the laser cutter is much higher. You can get a cheap Chinese laser for like $500-$600.
Yeah.
But it's not going to last very long, and it's huge, and it's going to be expensive to get rid of. The glow forges and stuff like that you can get for, I think they start at $2,500, and it is eminently useful.
Yeah.
We find ourselves cutting stuff especially right now. We're cutting stuff a lot just because it's fun to laser stuff.
I mean, have laser will cut is the old saying, right?
My friend Dan, who's the president of Glowforge, says once you have a when the tool you have is a laser, everything looks like it should be cut.
Sure.
Which is
see that
is fair.
Yeah, for sure. Let's see. Why don't we do a couple of old PC emails real Ooh. Fast? Daniel from Los Angeles. I'm thinking of replacing the motherboard and CPU in my old computer, or maybe just building an entirely new PC. What's your preferred method of reselling old PCs and computer parts? I live in a small apartment, and I don't like wasting space. Also, I like money.
I like money too, Daniel.
I've never, so I don't have a good answer for this, because this is a problem that has plagued me for the last 20 years. I've never tried to resell a computer, because by the time I'm done using it, it's so old that I don't think it has a lot of value. Although, I mean, I guess you could always get rid of something for $50. I mean, somebody will always find a use for an old, like an 8-year-old computer, but.
Yeah, so in the old days before school systems had IT and charities had IT departments, the answer to this question would have been go find an elementary school that doesn't have enough computers and give them your old computer, because it'll probably be better than what they have.
Yeah.
But now they all use Chromebooks and iPads and stuff like that. So it's like your average school IT guy isn't going to take my 5-year-old busted gaming PC. They're going to be like, just recycle that or donate it to a charity or something.
You just made me worry that we're part of a dying breed of people who cares about buying or building computers. I mean, that's probably not true. There's a thriving industry of gaming.
I think
DIY
that
stuff, but
I mean, I think that the rise of stuff like the Mister and the people making custom embedded systems makes me not worry. People have been worrying about that since I started at Ars Technica and Maximum PC in like 2000. I'm not worried about that.
Obviously building your own computer is not going anywhere, but
no, we'll be able to do that for a long time. When the iPad landed, everybody's like, well, this is the end of the desktop PC. Has not at all been the case.
Yeah.
So electronics recycling for stuff that's too old to be worth fooling with. I have all of every old hard drive I think I've ever owned, except for the one that was in my very first Wang, is in a huge box in my garage. I haven't bothered to pay to have them shredded.
Yeah. Yeah. I also have a box of old hard drives and old cards, various, I don't know if there's any Visa local bus cards in there, but there's definitely old PCI cards and stuff like that.
I donated a bunch of my old cards because I had a bunch of weird prototype video cards and stuff from Maximum PC days. And I donated those to the Computer History Museum. I think only wanted one of them at the end.
Nice.
So here's what I would say. If you have a friend or family member, if it's something that's new enough that has value, Craigslist is better than eBay for me as a buyer. Like I don't generally buy stuff from eBay that's used electronics, because it's just really easy to get burned.
Yeah.
So I would advise against selling stuff on eBay for the exact same reason. You don't want to you don't want to hear from the person you sold the thing to on eBay 3 days later and have them be like, hey man, that video card you sold me for $50 doesn't work. Cause then it's going to eat way more than $50 worth of time dealing with lunatic eBay buyers.
Yeah.
Craigslist is good. Donating, like I pass down a lot of hardware, like old laptops go to my parents and they are thrilled, because like a 3-year-old laptop for me is infinitely newer than what they have.
Totally. I have built a computer for my parents out of old stuff, although even they are just on MacBooks now. So like you said, a lot of society has just moved on from this.
I finally got my mom to get rid of the Dell that she's had. I mean, she hasn't gotten rid of it, but like she's using a laptop now instead of a Dell, like a Dell desktop, because she moves around a fair amount. And It's nice to be able to sit in the living room and use the computer to do her stuff while she's watching TV instead of being locked in the little computer room that was a laundry room 20 years ago.
So here's something I just thought of while we're talking about this, which is that we've kind of talked about this before, and we need a good term for it that we have reached. There's some intersection of like the computing needs, like, you know, horsepower and memory that like a modern OS or whatever needs, and the progress of that stuff. I feel like we have hit an inflection point where like, the needs of like you're just running an OS for web browsing and email and like the basics, if you're not playing games and stuff, like we like cheap, good hardware have blown past those needs.
So I would argue that happened in like 2010.
Yes, totally.
When the iPhone 4 launched,
let me just kind of let me kind of illustrate what I'm talking about here, because it ties into this question. So in 2010, I built a Core i7-860.
Okay.
Which is hopelessly outdated now, right? Like it's very power inefficient. It doesn't have the horsepower you need to do most modern stuff. But what I'm on right now is an i7-7700K, which is also getting a little older. It's not totally obsolete yet, but like we're getting to the point where I'm going to need something new in the next 2-3 years at latest.
I upgraded off of that generation of CPU last year, and I absolutely did not need to.
That's where I'm going with this, is that I feel like the next time I upgrade, it's going to be a different situation than it's been in the past, because in all those cases, the computer I was getting rid of is kind of too old and slow to do much with or even really want to give away. But if I build like a new Ryzen system next year or the year after, like this, it's not like the 7700K is going to be useless, you know? So like we actually are finally, I think, getting to the point where like your old computer could actually still totally be repurposed for something or be of value to somebody, just because we've passed that point where like your 40-year-old computer can still run the current version of Windows 10 just fine, right?
Well, we've been at that point for a long time. The computer that my mom is using at home, the desktop, is a machine that I think shipped with Windows 7 and like 6-8 gigs of memory or something. It's not a beefy computer, and it's fine.
Yeah. For Windows 10.
The thing I've been doing is moving my old gaming PC into the NAS box, moving the hardware from that into the NAS box, which there's pros and cons to that. It uses way more power than you should for a NAS box.
Yeah.
But it is a really beefy computer. If you want to do something stupid like transcode video on it, you can.
Yeah.
The thing that happens with those is eventually the CPUs start getting wonky because they run 24/7 for years. Like the last one I had was that same generation as your CPU, was the generation of, so I went from whatever the 6-core version of the CPU that you listed first, the A60, to Broadwell E.
Okay.
And like, it was fine. Like I didn't need to upgrade that server at all.
Right.
I just had I replaced the hardware in my main PC, and I had a spare motherboard and CPU memory. I was like, well, this one's starting to get a little janky. It's crashing more than I'd like. I'm going to put the new hardware in there this time.
So when you say wonky, you're basically talking about just the kind of total lifespan of the CPU. Like I think I've seen, what is it, like a decade or something is kind of the most you should expect to get out of a CPU before it kind of goes south. Is that right?
What happened to me was actually the memory was failing.
Okay.
And getting 8-year-old memory was more expensive than just replacing just switching out the other hardware. It was going to be $350 to get 8 gigs of ancient ass memory to replace the 8 gigs that were breaking.
I mean, the reason I ask is like, do you know what's causing that breaking, like electrically or at the hardware level? Do you know what is degrading?
I'm sure it's just electrical. I'm sure it's just like the over time, the
transistors
leakage between traces on the memory or something.
I see. Yeah. So just kind of materials degradation.
Like, over time, those things are running at reasonably, like they're not running at like 400 degrees, but they're running at a couple hundred degrees Fahrenheit or 100 degrees Celsius ish. And over time that the hardware, the silicon degrades.
That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. It doesn't insulate remembering stuff from like conversations 10 years ago while drinking at CES. My understanding is that over time the silicon insulates less well between the traces, but I don't know that that's the case. Please correct me if that's wrong.
The good news, if you're running like a home server or NAS or something, is that like these beefy gaming CPUs that we're using to run our boxes, like by the time those crap out or you need something new, like the base level, like Core i3 category of CPU is superior to those in every way.
Well, And also with Linux based systems, it's pretty easy to just pull out the old machine, or FreeBSD or Linux based systems. It's easy to swap the old hardware out, do a clean install, and then just connect your data pool and restore the system set.
Totally. All right. Couple more emails real fast, except I totally lost the one that I was going to read. So let me just fill here. Here it is. Joey in Burlington, Ontario. I have a Corsair HX650W80+ Gold certified power supply that I purchased in 2010 that I have used in the various incarnations of my main gaming PC ever since. This thing has stood up to SLI video cards, overclocked CPUs, tons of fans, the works. 10 years later, it is still working well with seemingly solid stability, but it is now 3 years out of warranty, and I'm starting to get a little nervous about running a decade-old power supply in my main gaming rig. Is it time for a replacement, or should I ride it out a little longer? I guess pretty related question, actually, to what we were just talking about, except about power supplies. I don't have a good answer for this.
My power supply is probably close. It's probably 7 or 8 years old. Yeah. It's been a long time since I upgraded a power supply. I mean, I find usually I can tell that power supplies are dying because the machine starts crashing for random reasons. Yeah. Sporadic. Like there's no, like it basically like you get under load and sometimes it crashes and sometimes it doesn't.
Yes.
Usually it crashes more in the summer when it's hot, when you have a hotter room.
Yeah.
If your machine's not crashing, if stuff's not acting weird, I wouldn't. Like if you're worried about it being out of warranty, you could buy a replacement and just let it sit in a box in your closet so it's ready to go when it conks out, because it will die eventually.
Yeah.
But
I guess the big question is, like, is there any real potential for it to damage the other hardware when it goes?
Well, so the way power supplies are designed is that when they fail, they're supposed to isolate, like they're not supposed to surge into the DC side of the power supply. So into the computer side of the power supply.
So you should be relatively protected there.
I mean,
nothing is guaranteed.
Nothing's guaranteed. The whole point of the power supply is like if your house gets hit by lightning and lightning goes into your computer, the point is that the power supply is supposed to blow up before the energy comes in and fries your computers.
Right.
The delicate parts of your computer. I feel like letting the power supply ride is probably not going to hurt anything.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm doing it.
Mine's getting up there too. The only time I ever remember losing a power supply, the way it manifested was that the machine would spontaneously reboot itself a lot.
Yeah.
Specifically like when I would fire up a game and stuff like that. So that's maybe one thing to look for.
So it's tricky because that's often memory too. Sure. Because memory tends to conk out after four or five years in my experience. Especially if you're like talking about high clocked gamer memory, that's maybe not cooled as much as it should be. Troubleshooting, like part of the hard part of having a computer where you have one computer in your house is when something goes wrong, you don't have a bunch of spare parts around to swap in and see, like isolate exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
So, you know, having that second power supply, maybe not a terrible idea, especially like if you're working from home and you need like a day without the computer is a day without you getting paid.
Yeah.
You might want to, it's maybe worth thinking about adding a little bit of backup.
It's a good feeling to have a backup.
Yeah.
Okay. Two more emails real fast. This one was signed from Brad's old monitors. I don't appreciate that at all. But here we go.
On the floor now.
Yeah. Will, you mentioned living in about 1,000 square foot house. Do you have any tips or advice for maintaining a happy family in such a relatively small space? My partner and I are expecting our first kid this year, and we're living in approximately 1,000 square feet, though with a big yard. We both grew up in larger homes with more space and more room. I'm worried we don't have enough space, even though we certainly do.
I grew up in a much larger home with 15 acres surrounding it. So first off, congratulations.
Yeah.
I think the benefit of living in a small house, says the coastal urban elite, is you end up like your kid is by necessity going to be more empathetic than they would be if they could just fuck off into the basement and be left alone whenever they want. Like,
okay.
You have to be one of the things that Gina and I talked about when we moved into this house, and it was just us 10 years ago, is that because we had moved from a much larger apartment with multiple bathrooms, is that like you have to do the things to help each other without somebody asking. Like if you see a mess, we just have to stay on top of mess and clutter and stuff like that all the time.
Because everybody there
gets out of control.
Everybody is subjected to the same messes.
Yeah. And like, you can't be like, hey, did you see the thing on the kitchen counter? You got to clean that up. You got to just do it in advance. And you like my daughter knew at four that like when she was done eating, she picked up the plate and put it in the sink. Part of it is I like this is just normal human advice, but it's not tech advice, but just paying attention to the things that make your partner and the other people that live in your house crazy and doing what you can to minimize your impact on that. Because everybody has stuff that makes them crazy. And yes. Yeah, like the you just end up being really, really try to be more self-aware of your footprint and your nightmare.
Be considerate of the people around you.
Yeah. This is just not that easy. Revolutionary advice.
One simple trick for cohabitating with other human beings.
But I mean, and then the nice thing about the kid is that ramps gently. So the bad thing that we've done, and I don't really regret it, but it is frustrating, is that like we have a bookshelf in our dining room. You've seen it. The toy bookshelf in our dining room is like, my daughter's bedroom is very small. We have a big bed in it. So when guests come, they can stay with us. And, you know, she either sleeps in a sleeping bag in my office or in with bed with us. And it means that she doesn't have a lot of room to play or like for a big shelf full of toys in her bedroom. So that shit's all in our dining room.
Sure.
And like, it's not ideal, but it works. Like you have to make, you have to pick and choose where you're going to have your compromises and where you're going to hold firm.
Sure.
Tell your in-laws and your family not to get a bunch of fucking toys though.
Oh, that's man. This really is just my stream of consciousness.
Yeah. Let's do it, week. Man. We're this deep in already.
This just popped into my head. Do you have any tips on repairing an air mattress?
Just buy a new air. Is it one of the ones with the motor or is it like
one
you have to?
It's a nice one that is relatively new and hasn't even been used much and is fully motorized and everything. And let's say we left it out in the floor, rolled up, but exposed.
Oh, no.
While a couple
it got brittle?
While a couple of small rodents were being allowed to roam freely.
You got pigged.
And one of them thought that it looked like something that would be fun to take a bite out of. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny little puncture hole.
The mattress came with a kit that has the right glue for the material the mattress is made out of.
I don't think this one did. We must have tossed it then because I Googled and I couldn't find that this model came with the patch kit, but if it did, we threw it out. I don't know where it is. There's a bunch of like vinyl repair kind of chemical adhesive super gluey type things out there. I ordered one of those for $6. The Amazon reviews seemed pretty glowing unless those have been manipulated that this works.
So find out what material the mattress is made out of and then match the kit to that. If it's a vinyl kit, use a vinyl kit.
Shit.
Because the glue's hard.
Okay. I should have done my research a little better. I assumed this thing was vinyl.
Well, I mean, it probably is. The one that we have is vinyl. Just make sure, because if you use the wrong glue, I mean, in some cases they don't even use glue; they just use solvent that melts the top few layers and lets you like rebind atoms at a real molecular level. So it's not even glue; it's just like dissolving bonds and then letting the bonds reform when the solvent evaporates.
Okay.
If you use the wrong glue, it'll melt all the way through and it'll fuck up the thing much, much worse.
Yikes.
If you use the right glue, it'll probably fix it for a while. I've not had fantastic luck fixing holes in vinyl.
That's not
air mattresses.
That's not encouraging at all.
It also depends on where it is. Like if it's in a place that's flat, that'll be easy. If it's in a place that's on a bend, then you're boned probably.
It is a place that creases when we fold it up.
So that might be, I mean, look, it's not going to make it worse by trying to fix it.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
That's just very frustrating.
Just make the guinea pig sit there with her paw on it and hold her finger over the hole anytime somebody's...
Don't worry. Her criminality has been discussed heavily over the last couple of days.
You're not going to name names?
I'm not going to put any guinea pigs on blast here, but...
Wow.
Coughlin's number 8880 Airstop is the stuff that I bought.
Yeah, let me let
like
it rip.
Anything that's named after like the guy who founded the company and has a number in the product name, I feel like is going to be hardcore. So that's what.
All your best glues have a number. Yeah. I like Super 77. That's a 3M product.
Totally.
It's great. You glue all sorts of stuff to stuff with that.
Air mattresses is the first thing on the package listed. It says small repairs of air mattresses, ground sheets, rainwear, pools, boats, and toys. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean.
Hopefully.
You're not going to make it worse.
Yeah. You're right. This packing tape over the hole has not been working out. All right.
No packing. No. Yeah.
It's not airtight in my experience. Okay. Last email. I'm going to keep this one anonymous by request. This person is an MD MPH at a major hospital.
Like Neil Patrick Harris?
No. MPH.
Oh, I thought you were talking about, I thought they were very young and they were Doogie Howsering, maybe.
I believe that is Masters of Public Health, not Neil Patrick Harris. Not Neil Patrick Harris.
This whole bit is really awkward now.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, this person does seem to be quite credentialed, so I feel pretty good about this information. I really enjoyed the latest episode on coronavirus. Also, this is a coronavirus email if you don't want to, if you're done with that. If you're looking to escape, then
we're not going to do anything else good for the rest of this episode. Yes, this is it.
So you can
we're going to talk about the Patreon. You should sign up for the Patreon. It's at patreon.com/techpod.
Yeah.
So and if you don't want to hear about coronavirus, you can go now. We'll see you next week.
This is really good information for people to have, though, as testing as testing is in the news more and more. I found this stuff pretty edifying.
It's important background for how the tests work and why the different ones are important that we didn't get into last week or maybe made errors on.
Yeah. He says, yeah, I enjoyed the latest episode on coronavirus and its effects on society and economy. However, I have to make a correction to your statements about PCR and serologic testing. Okay, here we go. It's a bit of info, but PCR testing is an extremely important component of detecting infectious diseases. At the hospital where I work, we run PCR tests for influenza and another common virus in children called respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, whenever they are admitted for a respiratory illness. From the emergency room, this test comes back in 1 to 2 hours, much faster than the 24-hour turnaround time quoted in the episode. Our current COVID-19 PCR test, outsourced to a local lab with deliveries from our hospital being made several times per day, takes about a day to come back because we have to wait for the sample to go to the lab, test to be run, and then results to be sent back to our medical record system. In short, PCR is very fast. The main downside it has is that it can't differentiate viable virus, in other words, capable of causing infection, from the remnants of dead virus that has already been inactivated by a person's immune system, heat, or other factors. PCR is generally very sensitive and specific, meaning that it has very few false positives and false negatives, depending on the test in question. Okay. With me so far?
Yeah, I gotcha. Okay. I used to do PCRs when I was in, in college, but it was different than what they do now.
Okay. So yeah, PCR is looking for traces of the actual virus.
Yes.
Okay. Next, second half of this. Serologic testing is important, and it can tell you if there's an acute immune response to an infection and or a prolonged immunologic memory of a past infection. Most tests involve testing for two molecules called immunoglobulin M and immunoglobulin G. I will refer to them as M and G from here.
Okay.
M is usually a marker of acute infection, while G means that there was an infection in the past that your body remembers, meaning that it should be able to recognize the infectious agent again in the future.
Acute infection means you are actively sick at the moment.
And actively infected. Okay. An example of this would be varicella or chickenpox. Someone who's had chickenpox or received the vaccine will have G antibodies present, but M antibodies absent. By contrast, someone with an active chickenpox infection, blisters and fever and all, would probably have M present, but G present only later, closer to when they're recovering. There are exceptions to this G-M division, but for most of diseases, this is how it works. Serologic tests aren't necessarily faster. They probably take a similar amount of time as PCR tests. We get some serologies back in hours as well. The bottom line is that both tests are important, but in the acute phase of this pandemic, in which we need to find people who have viral particles somewhere in their upper respiratory tract, PCR is, in my opinion, the more important test right now, and the one being focused on by most testing labs and public health departments. And that's pretty much it. So
There we go. That's super good info. Thank you so much, anonymous listener, for sending that in.
So PCR are looking for people who are actively sick or at least have traces of the virus present. But it seems like the serological testing is going to become more important later in like in a later phase of this when we need to start figuring out who has had it.
Well, I mean, they're already looking for people who have been sick and recovered that they can harvest antibodies from to give to the sickest people, I think, in New York and other places.
But also in just in terms of, you know, they're talking about there being a lot of people who are borderline asymptomatic.
Yeah.
That don't actually know they've had it. Like, you're going to need to identify those people as well and know that they are presumably fairly immune and actually safe to maybe go back out into society.
This is a thing I was joking about with people on Twitter weeks ago, where the people who quarantine and just stay quarantined forever are going to become one faction in the after times.
Oh boy.
And the people who got sick and got better are going to be the other faction. And you're going to be able to tell us apart from our beards.
I don't like where this is going. Because
if you're in quarantine, you got to not have a beard so the mask works. And if you're a post-infection scab, then this is too dark. Sorry.
That is way over the Mad Max threshold. Let's just let's pull it back a little bit for this week.
So I guess that'll do it for us this week.
Yeah.
If you have questions, you can send them to techpod@content.town.
Yeah.
If you would like to tell your friends about the podcast, which we love, it's our favorite thing in the world, is when we see people saying, "Hey, there's this great podcast I listen to. I should tell my friends."
Yeah.
You can tell them where to find it at techpod.content.town.
Yeah. And always love suggestions on what we have been talking about, what you would like us to talk about, what you want us to stop talking about. I would just love to know what
I think we're going to start posting when we plan out far enough in advance to have next week's topic well in advance. I think we're going to start posting that stuff in the Discord.
Okay.
So that people can find out, and you can get access to the Discord by signing up for the Patreon.
Yep.
The address for that again is patreon.com/techpod. If you have signed up and you do not have Patreon access, Discord access yet, please, 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 please mash that message button on Patreon, and I will help you. One of us will help you figure out how to get in, because it seems like the Patreon to Discord syncing process kind of sucks. Several hundred backers. We've only had a handful of people that have not been able to connect, but I definitely have had some people that through no fault of their own have not been able to connect. And we want to get you in there. If you're supporting the show, we're up to 300 patrons.
That's awesome. Yeah. Super grateful for everybody's support. And again, I know I just keep broken record here, but just the amount of knowledge that this group of people has is just absolutely astonishing.
As we have been doing, let's see, this week we added, the only thing we added this week was food and other things that you put in your mouth.
Yes. Yes.
Food and other things we eat.
But yes, the channel list is slowly growing there. So that's fun.
We're managing it. We're paying attention to what people are talking about in general. And when it gets too in the weeds, we just add a new channel and move the conversation in there.
We have that power.
I think we need a gaming channel, probably, is my guess, because people are talking about games a lot in the general channel, but maybe general is just games. I don't know.
We are as gods when it comes to creating channels on the Discord.
We are the Alpha and the Omega. We are the creators and the destroyers of channels.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for, it was good to talk to you, Brad.
Yeah, it was fun.
It's nice to see you every week, man.
Some social interaction here and there. Who would have thought?
Yeah, I mean, I know you guys are absolutely just, like, the amount of stuff you are producing on Giant Bomb on the reg right now is incredible.
Streaming.
Yes.
Just getting on there and streaming. I dug out my Wii U yesterday.
Ooh, what'd you play?
I played Super Mario 3D World, which is a fantastic game.
Very good video game.
It's a very good game.
I've been thinking about digging out the Wii or the Wii. I mean, the Wii U is still connected. I was thinking about digging it out so I can introduce my daughter to Galaxy, but I'd have to find a sensor bar someplace.
Well, if you can hold out. You know, word on the street is that stuff might be coming to a Switch near you at some point.
I think I'd rather not pay for, well, I mean, it would be nice to have it in 4K, I guess.
Yeah. Hey,
or,
if you want
1080p, whatever.
If you want Mario Galaxy in 4K, that can be attained. There are options.
God, do I want my, oh, wow. Yeah, I have Dolphin and I ripped the ROMs from my Wii before I put the Wii in the garage.
You are legally entitled to play that game on your computer, I believe.
Yeah, that does read.
Yeah.
And as always, a huge thank you to our executive producer level patron, David Allen. Thanks, David. See y'all next week. Bye, everybody.